Welcome again. This is Thelma English, and I'm going to begin reading Book 3 of Virgil's Aeneid. We're using the Robert Fitzgerald translation. Make sure you have your copy of your book nearby. The Aeneid, Book 3 by Virgil. In Book 3, we're going to see Aeneas and some of his followers. They try and settle in the Phrygian mountains. They're going to build a fleet of ships, and they plan to set sail in the summer. And they have several locations where they attempt a new Troy, Thrace, Polydorus, Delos, Crete. They're going to go to the island of Strophades, which is near Sparta. But harpies are there, and the harpies actually tear the food right out of the hands of Aeneas's men. Aeneas gets cursed by their leader, the harpy Celiano. And then we're going to learn about Neoptolemus and Andromache and Helenus. So Neoptolemus, called in the Aeneid Pyrrhus, Achilles' son, had taken Andromache, Hector's wife, as a captive. So the Greek warrior's son, Neoptolemus, gets, of course, the Trojan king and queen's daughter-in-law as captive, which would be horrible, of course, for Andromache, and they killed her son. So when he died, when Achilles' son died, then Helenus, a Trojan prophet, and Hector's brother marries her. So Hector's brother Helenus marries his former sister-in-law. He also inherited Chaonia, which is a modern-day near modern-day Actium on the western coast of Greece. And Helenus has created a little miniature Troy there with Andromache. And Helenus warns Aeneas that he better appease Juno because she's the main source of his problems. Hera, Juno is mad at him, and he better make some sacrifices. Then they go to Sicily, and of course he encounters the Cyclops, because remember, this part of the story is just like Odysseus's wanderings in the Odyssey. So they go to Sicily, they encounter the Cyclops, and Aeneas, just like Odysseus, who now is called Ulysses, encounters Scylla, encounters Charybdis, and escapes the Cyclops, just like Odysseus. Then we have the death of Anchises, Aeneas's father. Fate strikes, Aeneas's father dies, which makes it so that Aeneas will be able to travel a little faster. Aeneas pauses in this narrative to the Carthage queen Dido, and his audience is just left in awe at the end of Book 3, because this is still Books 2 and 3. Remember, this is Aeneas telling Dido his entire story. So he's just wowed her in Book 2 with how faithful of a husband he was and all of that. Book 3. Now our high masters had seen fit to visit upon the Asian power of Priam's house, unmerited ruin, and the sea god's town, Poseidon's town, proud Ilium, Troy, lay smoking on the earth. And their high masters, of course, are the gods and goddesses. They saw fit to let Poseidon's town burn, lay smoking on the earth. Our minds were turned by auguries of heaven, so they see signs from heaven, to exile in far quarters of the world. So they're not going to stay and rebuild. They kind of have signs from heaven, and the Trojans think we're supposed to go somewhere else. By Antander, below Ida's hills, we toiled to build a fleet, though none could say where fate would take or settle us. Then we held muster of all our able-bodied men. When summer had just begun, Anchises gave the word to hoist sails to the winds of destiny. Weeping, I drew away from our old country, our quiet harbors, and the coastal plain where Troy had been. I took to the open sea, borne outward into exile with my people, my sun, my hearth guides, and the hearth gods, and the greater gods. Beyond that water lies the land of Mars, or Ares, great plains plowed by the men of Thrace. Remember, the Thracians are very vicious people, and ruled in ancient days by cruel Lycurgus. Guesthood and common household gods had bound this realm to Troy while fortune held. Now making landfall, so they used to be held under the sway of Troy, but now Troy is destroyed, so they're not going to really like Trojans. Now making landfall under the south wind there, I plotted out on that curved shore the walls of a colony, though fate opposed it, and I devised the name Aeneide for the people. So this is a use of patronymics. He found a place and he thinks, well, I'll name it after myself, the Aeneide for the people, from my own. As I made offering to Dione's daughter, Dione is daughter of the ocean and Tethys, who is actually mother to Venus. As I made offering to Dione's daughter, my divine mother, and to other gods who give protection to a work begun, I readied for the knife there by the sea, a sleek bull, to the overlord of heaven. So Aeneas is going to sacrifice a bull. Now, as it happened, the ground rose nearby, and a low a low hummock, overgrown with cummel and myrtle saplings, flickered in a thicket. I stepped over, trying to tear away green stuff out of the mound to make a roof of boughs and leaves over the altar. There I had sight of a gruesome prodigy beyond description when the first stalk came torn out of the earth and the root network burst. Dark blood dripped down to soak and foul the soil. So he reaches down to rip out some grass, and blood drips from it. Shuddering took me. My heart's blood ran slow and chill with fear. But once more I went forward and fought to pull another stubborn shoot, to find what cause lay hid there. And again, dark crimson blood ran out of the ripped bark. My spirit strove hard. I paid reverence to nymphs of the wild woods and Father Mars, Ares, guardian of Thrace, that they might make this vision turn to good and lift away the omen. Then I doubled my effort a third time, wrenched at a green shoot, grappling on my knees against the sandy ground. Should I tell this or hold my peace? A groan came from the mound, a sobbing muffled in the depth of earth, and words were carried upward. Ooh, must you rend me, derelict that I am, Aeneas? Spare me. Now I am in the grave. Spare your clean hands' defilement. I am no foreigner. Old Troy gave birth to me. This blood drips from no tree. Ah, put the savage land behind you. Leave this shore of greed, for I am Polydorus. Polydorus, this is the youngest son of Priam, slain by the Thracians. I am Polydorus. An iron hedge of spears covered my body, pinned down here, and the pointed shafts took root. At this, be sure that in a maze of dread I stopped appalled. My hair stood up, my voice choked in my throat. This man, this Polydorus, ill-starred Priam had sent some years before, in secret, with great weight of gold, to be maintained by the Thracian king. So Priam had sent his son Polydorus to Thrace with a bunch of treasure to say, keep it safe for us, maintained by the Thracian king. That was a time when Priam's trust in Dardan arms had faltered, and he saw Ilium ringed with siege. The Thracian, after the shattering of Trojan power, after fortune had left us, threw in his lot with Agamemnon's cause and winning arms, broke every pact and oath, killed Polydorus. So when Troy fell, Thrace joined the Greek cause, and they take all the treasures they were supposed to protect, and killed his son Polydorus, and took the gold by force. To what extremes will you not drive the hearts of men, accursed hunger for gold? When faintness of dread left me, so this is Aeneas telling the story again, he's just spoken with this ghost of Polydorus, who apparently is buried there and his blood still flows. When faintness of dread left me, I brought before the leaders of the people, my father first, these portents of the gods, and asked their judgment. All were of one mind. We should withdraw from that earth stained with blood, with guesthood so profaned. So Aeneas has been very, very much defiled. With guesthood so profaned, and give our ships the winds and sea again. For Polydorus, therefore, we held a funeral. On his grave we heaped up earth, and altars to the dead were decked with night-blue bands and cypress gloom, round which our women mourned with their hair unbound. We brought up foaming bowls of milk with shallow cups of consecrated blood to pour, and put to rest the spirit in the tomb, giving the last loud cry. When the seas offshore looked promising and smiled back at the wind, a halyard snapping land breeze calling seaward, our men out of the beaches, launched the ships, and out we sailed as shorelines fell behind. Mid-sea, a holy island lies, most dear to Aegean Neptune, Poseidon, and the Nereid's mother. Once in its course afloat from coast to coast, the filial archer god, that'd be Apollo, had tied it up to Myconus, the sea mark, and to Gyrus, enabling it to rest, to scorn the winds. Here we put in, and the serene island haven welcomed our tired men. We went ashore in pilgrimage to Apollo's town. King Aeneas, both king of Delians and priest of Phoebus, Apollo, garlanded in snowy wool and laurel, came to meet us, greeting his old friend Anchises. We joined hands, then at his side entered the temple of the god. I paid my homage to that shrine of ancient stone, praying, O God of Thymbra, grant a home and walls to weary men. Grant us posterity, and an abiding city, guard our second tower of Troy, this remnant left alive by Danaan swords and pitiless Achilles. So Aeneas is asking Apollo for guidance. Where should these refugees go? Whom should we follow? Or by what seaway dost thou direct us? Where may we settle now? Father, grant us a sign. Enter our hearts. These words were barely uttered, line 125, when it seemed of a sudden everything shook. Door sills and laurel, the whole ridge around us quaking, and the cauldron sang low from the sanctum, now thrown open. We pitched down, prone, and a voice rang in our ears. And this is a prophecy foretelling of Aeneas that he's going to rule the world's shores. Ooh, tough sons of Dardanus, the selfsame land that bore you from your primal parent stock will take you to her fertile breast again. Look for your mother of old. Aeneas's house in her will rule the world's shores down the years. And down the years they'll become Rome, and so Rome will rule. Rule the world's shores down the years through generations of his children's children. So rang the god's voice. So that was Apollo's oracle. Then our voices rose in tumult, jubilant, but everyone inquired what and where that place could be to which the gods summoned us wanderers and called it a return. So where could they wander to and call it a return? Because they're not going to go to Troy. So believe it or not, what they're going to find out is that they were actually the founders of Italy anyway. So they deserve to have Italy. That's what's going to happen. Line 140. Soon then, my father, calling up memories of ancient men, spoke out. So this is old Anchises remembering a story that makes them the owners of Italy too. Sirs, listen to me and be clear as to your hopes. Mid-sea, great Jove's great island, Crete, lies southward. There's Mount Ida. There, the cradle of our people. Cretans hold 100 cities, fertile and wide domains. From there, if I recall it well, our first forefather, Teucrus, sailed from the coast around Point Rotorum and chose it for his kingdom. As yet, no Ilium, Troy, stood, no citadel. The settlers lived in lowlands, river valleys. There was the origin of Mount Sibylus's mother goddess, with her Corybantes, brazen ringing cups, her grove on Ida. They were her mysteries, devoutly kept. And the yoked lions of Our Lady's car, so she has a chariot that lions pull. Come then, we'll follow where the gods command, court favor of the winds, and lay our course for Cnossus's country. No longer sail. Let Jupiter fill our canvas, and we breach on Crete at sunrise the third day. His counsel given, so Anchises' counsel given, he slaughtered ritual beasts upon the altar, because they're so pious, a bull to Neptune and a bull to thee, comely Apollo, to the god of storm, a black ram, and a white one to the zephyrs, the wind gods. Rumor now flew about that Crete's great captain, Idomeneus, had left his father's kingdom, driven away, so there were lands abandoned. So Virgil is telling us that Aeneas is a Trojan, and the land is theirs. The great captain, Idomeneus, has left his father's kingdom, driven away, so there were lands abandoned, free of our enemies, and homes on Crete awaiting settlers. Out from Ortygia's cove we spread our wings to fly over the sea, past Naxos and the Maenad Heights, then past Daunisa's greenery, Olerios and snow-white rifts of Paros, all the Cyclades that stud the reach of sea. We sailed along through channels between shore, on foaming shore, as men vied up at ship-handling, shouting out and cheering one another, on to Crete, on to our ancestors, and from astern the wind blew, freshening to chase us on. At last we ran into the ancient land of the Crutes. I could barely wait to build our hoped-for city walls, to be called Pergamum, I said. I urge the people who loved the name to love their new-found hearths and raise a citadel above the town. Our ships were not long cradled on dry land, our men not long engaged in marriages or sowing the new fields, while I gave out homesteads and laws, when, without warning, plague! So a plague hits these new settlers. Out of infected air to sap our bodies, came on to us pitiable to see, and came to blight our trees and crops, a year of death. People relinquished their sweet lives or dragged their wasted bodies on. The dog star burned our green plantations barren, and our grassland withered. Sickly stalks denied us food. Again to Delos's oracle, so to Apollo's oracle, and Phoebus, Apollo, father pressed me back on our sea track to beg again the favor of the god. What end would he afford our weariness? Where might we turn for help? Where set our course? line 205. Night deepened, sleep on earth held living things. But now the sacred images of the gods, the Phrygian hearth gods I had brought with me from Troy out of the fire, seemed to stand before me where I sleep. See, I have a little vision, and the little wooden hearth gods are standing up doing a little ditty. I saw them plain in the pure light cast by the full moon, edging its way into unshuttered windows. Then it seemed they spoke to comfort me with these words. So the little hearth gods are speaking to Aeneas. Ooh, all Apollo would have told you Delos regained. He will deliver here. See how he sends us here of his own will into your room. We are the gods who came along with you and joined your cause when Troy went down in flames. We are the gods who crossed the deep sea swell in ships at your command. And we are those who will exalt your stars to your sons to starry heaven and give your town dominion. You must prepare great walls for a great race. Keep up the long toil of your flight. Your settlement must be changed. This coast is not the one Apollo of Delos urged you toward, nor did he bid you stay on Crete. There is a country, Hesperia, that's Italy, the western land, as the Greeks have named it, ancient, full of manpower and war and fruitful earth. Onetorians lived there once, then by report new generations called it Italy after their leader. Our true home is there. Dardanius came from there. So now we learn, now Aeneas learns from these little wooden hearth gods that they, the Trojans, are the original Italians. And Iasus, forefather of our people, up with you. Be glad and tell your father, full of years, what has been said here with no room for doubt. Look for Carithus and Ausonian country. Lands under dictate Jupiter denies you. Breathless with awe at these appearances, at the divine voice, and all this no dream. No, for I saw them, large as life before me, the veiled heads and the faces near at hand. So cold sweat soaked me head to foot. I tore myself from bed. I lifted up my hands and voice to heaven, line 245. Then I poured pure offerings at the fire. These rites performed to my satisfaction, because he's very pious, I recounted all that strange event in sequence to Anchises, to his dad. He saw the ambiguity of the two ancestral lines, the double parentage, his late-born error about ancient places. And then he said, so Aeneas' dad is talking to him, now he's going to say, I remember. Son, pitied as you are against the fates of Ilium, Cassandra alone made such a prophecy to me. Now I remember. Cassandra prophesied this. But never nobody believes her, remember? I call it back now, how she would foretell this future for our people, saying often Hesperia, Italy, and the realms of Italy. But who could think the Trojans would migrate to evening lands? Or whom then, where the sun goes down, evening lands? Or whom then could Cassandra move by foresight? We should yield to Phoebus, Apollo, taking a better course, as we are shown. With this, we were all happy to comply. We soon abandoned the new colony, leaving few souls behind and making sail in the decked ships we took to the waste sea. When we had gained the offing to the west, no land in sight now but sky everywhere and everywhere the sea, a thunderhead rose high above us, bringing gloom and storm with crisping dark gray water. Soon the winds made the sea rise and big waves came against us. This way and that we tossed in the great welter. Low scud muffled daylight, night and rain wiped out the sky. Flash after flash of lightning ripped from the burst clouds. We were blown off course and veered in darkness over the waves. My pilot, Palinurus, himself could barely tell day from night, he said, with sighting nothing but sea above us, could not keep direction, so they're getting lost. 3 days on the deep sea, muffled in fog, 3 starless nights we wandered blind. At dawn on the 4th day we raised land, far away in clearing weather, line 285, hilltops and then smoke a spiral in calm air. Our sails came down, we took to the oars, no dallying. The seamen hewed up whirls of foam on the dark blue sea, pulling across it. Safe now from the storm wave, I took shelter first on the Strophades. These are islands west of the Peloponnese. The Strophades, for so the Greek name goes, islands that lie in the broad Ionian Sea. There nest the vile Caleno and her harpy sisterhood, shut out now from the house of Phineus, as they were frightened from old banquets there. No gloomier monster, no more savage pest and scourge sent by the gods' wrath ever mounted from the black Stygian water, flying things things with young girls' faces. These are harpies being described. Flying things with young girls' faces, but foul ooze below, talons for hands, pale, famished, nightmare mouths. When we pulled into port, what met our eyes but sleek herds in the meadows everywhere, and flocks of goats, no one attending them. Setting upon them with our swords, we sent up shouts to the gods, to Jove himself, to share the windfall with us. Then on the curving beach we set our couches for our savory feast. So they think the gods are with them. They sacrifice to Jove, and they set up their stuff. They're going to have a feast. But instantly, grotesquely whirring down, the harpies were upon us from the hills with deafening beat of wings. They trounced our meat, defiling everything they touched with filth, and gave an obscene squawk amid the stench. We tried again in a secluded gorge under a hillside. In thick shade of trees, we set our tables up, relit our altars, but the loud horde again from another quarter came out of hiding, swooped down on the prey with hooked feet, hunched to feed and spoil our feast. Line 320. I then gave orders to resort to arms and make war on the vicious flock. So he's going to fight harpies. My men did as commanded, laid their swords nearby, hidden in grass, and kept shields out of sight. Now when the birds flew down along the cove, once more with their infernal din, Messenius, from a high lookout, sounded the alarm on his brass horn. Into their midst my men attacked and tried a strange new form of battle to cut the indecent seabirds down in blood. But they received no impact on their feathers, took on their backs no wounding cut. Too quick they soared away into the upper air, leaving the prey half-eaten and befouled. Only Celeno perched on a high crag, a ghastly witch, brought words out, croaking down. So Celeno, the harpy, curses them. So this is a harpy cursing them. So war is all you give in recompense for slaughter of bulls and bullocks. Can it be, heirs of Laomedon from Troy? You'd arm for war to drive the innocent harpies from their country? Then put your mind on what I prophesy, a thing foretold to Phoebus, Apollo, by the Almighty Father, and by Apollo then to me. Now I, first of the Furies, will disclose it to you. Italy is the land you look for. Well, the winds will blow. You'll find your Italy. You'll be allowed to enter port, but you may never wall your destined city till deathly famine for the bloodshed here has made you grind your tables with your teeth. Okay, so Celeno the harpy has cursed them, and they're never going to find their new place until they grind their tables with their own teeth. Line 350. On this, she took wings back into the forest. But our men of a sudden felt their blood run cold and lost all heart. Not with arms now, but prayers and vows, they begged me to make peace, whether these foes were goddesses or birds, obscene and dire. My father, facing seaward, hands held out, invoked the heavenly powers, and pledged the rituals due them. Gods, he said, turn back this thing foreboded. Gods, avert disaster of that kind. Cherish your faithful. So Aeneas's dad is trying to intercede. Line 360. Hawsers were cast off at his word, and sheets paid out to tugging canvas, and the south wind filled the sails. Over the white-capped waves we fled while wind and pilot called our course, and soon out of the sea we raised Zacanthus's leafy bulk. So they soon see that it's an island near Ithaca, where Odysseus lives. Zacanthus's leafy bulk, Dulcinium and Same, craggy Neotrus, past the rocks of Ithaca, Laertes' realm, Laertes, Odysseus's father. We ran and curse that island, nurse of cruel Ulysses, Odysseus. So they curse Odysseus's island of Ithaca as they go by it. Before long, the cloudy peaks of the Leucaton mountain came in view, Apollo's promontory. Seamen are wary of. Here we put in and hauled up, tired near the little town, our anchors out, our sterns high on the shingle. Then, having gained this land beyond our reckoning, we purified ourselves in the sight of Jove, and lit with offerings our altar fires. Then, on the Actian shore, held games of Ilion, so they have games of Troy. The men, all naked, slippery with oil, that's quite a sight to imagine, fought bouts in our traditional wrestling style, glad to have run past all those Argive towns, the Greek towns, and carried out our flight amid our foes. The sun went slanting round the mighty year, near, and freezing winter came, roughing the sea with northern gales. Against the temple columns I nailed a shield, great Abbas carried once, that's a great Trojan leader. So here they're doing offerings, and they're having athletic games to celebrate getting past all those islands of their Greek enemies. All rounded bronze, and cut this legend on it. So he's carving something on this shield. Aeneas, from victorious Greeks, these arms. Then I ordered the rowing benches. Checking my page. Then I ordered the rowing benches manned, the harbor left behind. They made a race of it, my men, digging their oars into the swell and surging on. Phaeacia's hour. Airy towers. Phaeacia is a land ruled by Aelonus, a place where Odysseus visited. By Phaeacia's airy towers hove in sight and dropped away behind. We passed along the coastland of Epirus, this is northern Greece, to Port Caona, where we put in, below Buthotratum on the height. And here an unbelievable story reached our ears, that the Helenus, the son of Priam, now ruled over cities of the Greeks, as heir to Pyrrhus's wife and power. Andromache had found a husband of her nation. It made me stare, and in my heart I burned with measureless desire to speak to him. So the prophet son of Priam, Helenus, the husband of Andromache, in Little Troy, this is after the death of Pyrrhus, and Helena marries her. He marries his sister-in-law. So Pyrrhus, remember, was a son of Achilles and Diodeme. So Pyrrhus is like a fourth god. With measureless desire, I desire to speak to him, to learn of that strange turn of life. You know, how did Helenus get to marry his daughter-in-law, and what happened to Achilles' son, Neoptolemus? So upward, inland, I went, leaving the ports and ships, and as it happened, at that hour, she, Andromache, in a grove outside the city, beside a brook, thin replica of Simois, which is a river in Troy, was making from the ceremonial meal her offerings and libations in the dust. So Aeneas runs right into Andromache, calling the great shade at a tomb called Hector's, made by her an empty mound of turf where she had blessed twin altars for her tears. So she's created a tomb for Hector, and here is Andromache, also very pious. But when she saw me coming, saw the men around me in Trojan arms, her mind misgave, and gazing at this ghostliness in terror, she stood there, pale and rigid, till the warmth ebbed from her, and she swooned, so she's fainting. And it was long before she spoke, or barely spoke. Your face, can it be real? And you real, messenger, coming before me, goddess born, alive? So this is Andromache saying to Aeneas, oh my goodness, you're alive? Or if sweet daylight left your eyes forever, where is my Hector? Then she wept and filled the grove with wailing. I had difficulty forcing a few words out amid her passion, so overcome I felt, but murmured to her, alive, oh yes, through every mortal danger this world holds, I carry on my life. Be sure that what you see is real. Ah, tell me, since you were so bereft of such a husband, what change has come to your relief? What fortune worthy of the wife of Hector, Andromache? Then Pyrrhus's wife and slave. So last time I saw you, you were Pyrrhus's wife and slave. How'd you get to be the wife of Helena? She bent her head with eyes downcast and whispered, happiest of all was Priam's daughter, the virgin picked to die at the great tomb below Troy wall of all our dead enemy. She never had to bear the slave's allotment, never laid hands on a lord and master's bed. But when our native city burned, we others were shipped out through far seas. I bore the pride and insolence of Achilles' warrior son, being brought to bed in slavery of his child. He turned then to a bride in Laodicea, so Sparta. Then he wanted Leda's daughter, Hermione. And so Hermione is the daughter of Helen and Menelaus. He made me over to Helenus, to another slave, but now Pyrrhus is dead. So Achilles' son Pyrrhus, Neoptolemus, is dead. Orestes, hot with lust for her whom he thought stolen from him, and maddened by the Furies for spilt blood, caught Pyrrhus unprepared and cut him down before his father's altar. By that death, part of the kingdom passed to Helenus. He called the plains Caonian, the realm itself Caonia, from the Trojan Caon, and built a Pergamum, a citadel, called Ilium's, on this ridge. As to yourself, what winds of destiny gave you this voyage? Which of the gods impelled you, all unknowing, here to our coast? What of your child, Ascanius? Alive still, nourished still by the world's air? Even at Troy, one thought, But does the boy remember her, the mother who was lost? And do his father and his uncle Hector stir him to old-time valor and manliness? Line 470. So she poured out her questions, all in tears, her long and vain lament when the great soldier and son of Priam, Helenus, approached from the townside with many in his train. In his great joy at knowing us for kindred, he then led us to the city gate, by turns weeping and speaking. Walking along with him, I saw before me Troy in miniature. They've made a little Troy. A slender copy of our massive tower, a dry brooklet named Xanthus, and I pressed my body against a Scaean gate. Those with me feasted their eyes on this, our kinsman's town. In spacious colonnades, the king received them, and offering mid-court their cups of wine, they made libation, while on plates of gold a feast was brought before them. That day passed, and other days. Then sailing weather came, when canvas bellied out, filled by a south wind. Now I put questions to the seer, and I said, so Aeneas needs to have his fortune told. Trojan interpreter of the god's will, you know the mind of Phoebus, Apollo, you know his tripod, know the Apolline laurel, because the laurel is Apollo's wreath, know the stars, the tongues of birds, and all the signs of bird flight. Prophecy for me. As you know, the powers favored me with directions for my sailing. All the divine speech from the shrines agreed. I must find Italy, must pioneer in those far lands. The harpy called Celiano riddled the only strange and evil sign of pallid famine and the wrath of heaven. What dangers must I steer away from first? How set my course to conquer that distress? So Aeneas is asking this seer, how can I get around all this bad luck? Helenus cut down bullocks on his altar with ceremony, begged the gods for peace, unbound the sacred ribbons from his head, and took me by the hand, leading me in a tingle by the overshadowing power of Phoebus. Oh, in thy shrine, then with oracular voice, the priest addressed me. So the priest now is talking to him. Ooh, line 510. Born of the goddess, highest auspices are clearly to be seen for your seafaring. The Lord God deals out destiny so, and turns the wheel of change, so turns the world. A few things out of many shall I tell you, so you may cross the welcoming seas more safely, to find harbor in Ausonia, Italy. Other details of time come the parquet, those are the fates. Keep from Helenus and Saturn's daughter. Juno will not allow him speech of these. So the fates and Hera won't allow him to tell more than that. To Italy you think so near, with ports you think to enter, ignorant as you are, lies far past far lands by untraveled ways. You are to make the oar bend off Trinacia, that's Sicily, to pass the Ausonian water, pass Italy, lakes of the underworld, the island home of Circe the Aeneian, before your walls can rise. In a safe country. Here are signs for you to keep in mind. So he has to go to the lakes of the underworld. Here are signs for you to keep in mind. When in anxiety by a stream apart, beneath shore oaks you find a giant sow, big pig, snow-white reclining there, suckling a litter of 30 snow-white young, that place will be your haven after toil, site of your town. And have no fear of table-biting times. That was the curse on him, table-biting, biting all the wood they use for tables. Have no fear of table-biting times. The fates will find a way for you. Apollo will be at hand when called. So Apollo's going to take care of the curse of the harpies. Line 536. But now, avoid the shoreline to the west, a part of Italy lapped by the tide of our own sea. The towns are all inhabited by evil Greeks. Here the Locrians founded a colony. These are northern Greeks who went to Italy. They founded a colony, and Lyctian Idomeneus, this is the king of Crete, with soldiers took the Salentine plain. Here is that town of Philoctetes, remember the archer? Captain of Melobia, little Petilia, buttressed by her wall. Another thing. When you have crossed and moored your ships ashore, there to put up your altars for offerings, veil your head in a red robe against intrusions on your holy fires, omen unsettling sights amid your prayers. You and your company retain this ritual, veiling in the future. Let your progeny hold to religious purity thereby. So they have to wear red cloaks. Now then at sea again, as the wind takes you toward the Sicilian shore and headlands northward, dwindle up the narrows, of Pelorus. This is a promontory on northeast Sicily, a piece that sticks out. Steel for the coast to port, the seas to port, a long sail around, away from shores to starboard. These land masses in the past, they say, though one in broken mainland long ago in cataclysm leaped apart, a change that the long ages of the past could bring. The sea rushes in between to cut away Hesperia's flank from Sicily. So the sea rushes in to keep apart Italy and Sicily, and washed with narrow tide the sundered shores and towns. Now Scylla haunts the starboard side, Charybdis never appeased, the side to port, and deep in her whirlpool gulps down the great sea waves 3 times a day and spews them up again, sending the whiplash of her spray to heaven. Scylla lies immured in a rocky cave, in clefts of inky darkness, darting out her faces, pulling ships onto the reef. First she looks human, a fair-breasted girl down to the groin, but then, below, a monster creature of the sea, a wolfish belly merging in dolphins' tails. Better to round the sea mark of Pachynus and stand out to sea, taking the long route west, than sight weird Scylla in her overhanging gloom and froth of rocks where sea-green hounds give tongue. Further, if Helenus can look ahead, remember Helenus is the seer to Aeneas, he says, if Helenus can look ahead, if you can trust a seer, and if Apollo fills his mind with truth, so, you know, he's telling the truth, I have one thing to tell you over and over again, one thing to warn you of, son of the goddess, make your prayer first of all to Juno's goddess. Okay, Godhead. So no matter what you do, you gotta make up with Juno, because as long as she's angry at you, you're just in trouble. First of all, to Juno's godhead, chant with a will your vows to her. Secure with humble gifts the power of that lady. So, in the end, in triumph, with Trinacria, Sicily, left behind, you will be sent to Italy. Ashore there, when you reach the town of Cumae, and that's where the Cumaean symbol, Sibyl, is. She's also a priestess of Apollo. When you reach the town of Cumae, Avernus's murmuring forests, haunted lakes, you'll see a spellbound prophetess. Ooh. And Avernus is a lake that they associate with the underworld, too. This prophetess, who sings in her deep cave of destinies, confiding symbols and words to leaves. So the leaves rustle, and she reads the leaves. Whatever verse she writes, the virgin puts each leaf in order. Back in the cave, unshuffled they remain. But when a faint breeze through a door ajar comes into stir and scattle the light leaves, she never cares to catch them as they flutter, or to restore them, or to join the verses. Visitors unenlightened turn away and hate the Sibyl's shrine. But here, no thought of time spent in delay should count with you. Though crews reproach you, though the course you set, call seaward now, and you can fill your sails with wind in the right quarter. Even so, pray to the prophetess that she herself consent to utter and chant her oracles. She will inform you of the Italian tribes, the wars to come, the way you should avoid each difficulty or face it. Do her reverence, and she will bring you through by sea and land. These are the matters I may warn you of. Go and exult the might of Troy in action. When he had said all this in friendliness, the seer commanded gifts of heavy gold and carven ivory brought to the ships. Line 620. He stowed masses of silver between the decks with cauldrons of Dodona. This is of Dodona. That's a famous shrine of Jupiter near Bethutrum. Then a cuirass woven of chainmail, triply laced with gold, and a magnificent helm plumed at the peak, the arms of Neoptolemus. So they even bring him the armor of Neoptolemus, Achilles' son. Special gifts went to my father. Then he added horses, pilots too, and oarsmen as required, and fitted out my fighting men with arms. Meanwhile, Anchises ordered sails, unhoused, to catch a favoring wind without delay. Now the diviner of Apollo, the seer, bowing in august reverence, said to him, Anchises, chosen by Venus for the pride of marriage, cared for by heaven, brought to safety twice from ruined Pergamum, look toward your land, Ausonia, Italy, make sail for it and take it, and yet this shoreline must you skirt by sea. The sector of Ausonia, meant by Apollo, lies far away. Embark now, fortunate in the devotion of your son. Should I detain you more by more talk while the winds rise? So, no, time for you to go. Andromache, too, sat at this last farewell, brought out embroidered robes and cloth of gold, and for Ascanius a Phrygian mantle. Not to be outdone in courtesy, she gave armfuls of woven gifts, and said, "Take these things, too, and may they be remembrances of my hands, child, and token of my love, the long love of Andromache, Hector's dearest, final gifts of your own people. Take them, you that alone remind me of Astyanax." So Aeneas reminds Andromache of Astyanax. "His eyes, his hands, his look, all were like yours. He would be your age growing up like you." So Andromache is thinking of her little boy, Astyanax, who they threw off the Tower of Troy. And she says, "You kind of remind me of him." "I said farewell, and tears came as I spoke." Line 650. "Be happy, friends. Your fortune is achieved. While one fate beckons us, and then another, here is your quiet rest. No sea to plow, no quest for dim lands of Ausonia, receding ever. Here before your eyes are replicas of Xanthus and of Troy, your own hands built, with better auspices, I pray, and less a challenge to the Greeks. If one day I should enter Tiber stream and Tiber fields, and see the walls of my people have in store for them, then of these kindred cities, neighboring nations, in Epirus and Hesperia, both looking back to Dardanus as founder, both to one sad history, we shall make a single Troy in spirit. May this task await our heirs." So he's saying that these places in northern Greece and the western lands, Hesperia, Italy, he's saying someday we'll all live as one people. And of course, this is part of Virgil's way of presenting propaganda. Don't worry, all the people will be of one people. We'll all live as one people one day. And that's 1,000 years later when Rome rules everything. "We set sail for Ceraunia." It's a mountain chain in Epirus in Greece. "Nearby, to cross from there, the short sea route to Italy. The sun went west, the hills grew dark, then down we threw ourselves upon the welcome land, assigned the oars for the next day. Scattered all along the dry beach to take food and rest and sleep came soft as dew on tired men. Now night, drawn by the hours, had not yet reached the midpoint of her course, when Palinurus turned out briskly. Studying the winds, he cupped his ears to catch movements of air, observed the slowly wheeling constellations in the still heaven. Bright Arcturus, rainy Hyades, Great Bear and Little Bear, they're looking at constellations of stars, Orion in his belt of gold, all clear. In cloudless air he made them out to be, then gave a trumpet signal from the stern. So we broke camp, put out to sea, unfurled our wings of sails. The stars had vanished, dawn was reddening the sky, when far ahead we saw the blue hills and low-lying plain of Italy. Anchises shouted, 'Italy!' And all the men cried, 'Italy!' in joy. My father garlanded a great wine bowl, filled it with wine, stood on the stern aloft, and called to the gods." So they instantly make an offering, because obviously this is the Roman story, the Trojan story, and they are presenting themselves as quite pious. "Lords of the land and sea, storm powers, ease our way with a stern wind, steadily blow for us." Then, as desired, the light airs freshened, and an opening bay appeared as we drew in, backed by a temple upon an acropolis of Minerva, Athena. So they spot a temple of Athena. The sailors took in sail and rowed for shore. The harbor there, bent like a bow, recoils from seas out of the east. Long rocky spits make foaming surf. The port lies hid behind. Two crags like powers put out arms like walls, and the temple stands back inland. Here I saw our first portent, their first sign. In grassland, horses four, as white as snow, at graze in an open field. 'You bring us war, host land,' murmured my father. 'It is war, for war that horses are caparisoned. These herds mean war for us. Yet the same beasts are sometimes trained to take the chariot pole in harmony, to bear the yoke and bit. There is then hope of peace.' And there we prayed to the tall Pallas, Athena, goddess of clanging arms, first to receive us on that festal beach, then veiled our heads in Phrygian drapery." So since Phrygia is a reign of Troy, Trojans are sometimes called Phrygians, remember? "In Phrygian drapery before the altars, where by Helenus's particular command, we made burnt offerings in proper form to Juno of the Argives." They're trying to make Juno happy. "That ritual once complete, we would not stay, but swung our yardarms and our sails to take us out to sea again, leaving behind Greek territory treacherous in our eyes. Soon then we saw Tarentum's Gulf. This is far southern Italy. They want to go a lot further than that. Tarentum's Gulf, or Hercules, if the old tale be true. There, dead ahead, rose the Laconian Licinian goddess in her height at Juno. Then Colin's Tower and Scylla, the coast of shipwreck. On the distant sky, Trinacian Etna, Mount Etna, could be seen. And soon we heard big seas groaning on beaten rocks and voices of the breakers. Shoals leaped up before our eyes with sand in the sea swell, at which my father and Anchises cried, "No doubt of it, here is Charybdis, that abyss, and those perilous points of rock that Helenus foretold, with deadly ledges under sea. Sheer off, men, put your backs into the stroke." They bent hard to the rowing as commanded, and Palinurus in the leading ship swung his creaking prow over to port. The whole flotilla followed him in turn with oars and wind. On every rolling sea we rose to heaven, and in the abysmal trough sank down into the world of the shades. Three times the rock cliffs between caverns boomed. Three times we saw the wave shock and the flung spume drenching the very stars. The wind at last and sun went down together, leaving us spent, and in the dark as to our course, we glided quietly onto the Cyclops' shore. Here was a mighty harbor, in itself landlocked and calm, out of the wind's way. But Etna, just beyond, rumbled and flashed, so the mountain is thundering. Formidable in eruption, line 761. Up the sky she sent a sober cloud of billowing smoke, a pitch-black turban full of glowing ash and balls of fire to lick the stars. Below she vomited rocks and brought up lava streams, entrails of Etna boiling in the deep. The tale goes that the body of Enceladus, this is a titan who fought against Jupiter, the tale goes that the body of Enceladus, half consumed by thunderbolt, lies prone under that weight, prodigious Etna piled above him, a mountain on top of him, jetting flame from broken furnaces, and when the worn-out giant turns, all of Sicily rumbles and quakes and weaves a pall of smoke against the sky. Under the forest roof that night, we suffered monstrous fears. We could not see what made the din. There were no stars or starlight overhead. Only the cloud obscuring heaven and the depth of night withheld the moon in wrapped in stormy mist, so they can't see the moon or stars, and they just hear a bunch of noise. At long last rose the morning star. We felt day's onset as aurora thinned away, morning, the vapor of the night. Then suddenly, out of the forest, at the last extremity of hunger, came the strange shape of a man. So they spot this wild Greek guy who's going to beg them for help and mercy. The strange shape of a man in pitiful condition, his arms wide to beg for mercy. We took in the sight, his filth, his uncut beard, his ragged shirt pinned up by thorns. But even so, a Greek, and one sent on earlier day to Troy with Greek equipment. So they recognize him. Seeing at a distance, Dardan clothing, Trojan arms, he cringed and stopped a while in fear of what he saw, then stumbled onward to the shore headlong with tears and prayers. So here's this old Greek guy. He's more afraid of whatever's on the island than he is of these Trojan guys, his enemies. And he says, "In heaven's name," he said, "by all the powers I beg you, oh, by the light and air we breathe, take me with you, Trojans. Anywhere at all would be good enough for me. I know it, one of the Danaans, the Trojans, one of the fleet. I won't deny I fought to take Troy's gods. For that, if so much harm came of our devilry, cut me to bits, scatter me on the water, drop me in the sea. If I must die, death at the hands of men will be a favor." With this, line 805, he took our knees and groveled, kneeling, clinging there. And we told him to speak out, say who he was, born of what blood, what fortune put him in such a panic. And my father, after a moment, gave the man his hand to calm him by that touch and sign of mercy. In the end, he put aside his fear and said, I'm an Ithacan of Ulysses' company. So he's one of Odysseus's men. That man beset by trouble, Achaemenids, I'm called. My father, Adamastus, lived in poverty, so I shipped out for Troy. Would God our life of poverty had lasted. My shipmates left me here. They all forgot me, scrambling to get away from the cave mouth and frightfulness in the cavern of the Cyclops, that is a blood-soaked hall of brutal feasts, all gloom inside and huge. The giant rears his head against the stars. Oh, heaven, spare earth a scourge like this, unbearable to see, unreachable by anything you say, the innards and the dark blood of poor fellows are what he feeds on. I myself looked on when he scooped up two crewmen in his hand mid-cave, and as he lay back, smashed them down against the rock face, making the whole floor swim with spattered blood. I saw him crunch those dead men running blood and excrement to the warm flesh, still a-quivering in his teeth. Not that he did not suffer for the act, not that Ulysses, Odysseus, put up with that outrage or lost his self-possession in the pinch, gorged with feasting and dead drunk with wine, the giant put down his lolling head, lay down enormous on the cave floor. In his sleep he dribbled bile and bits of flesh mixed up with blood and wine. We prayed to the great gods, drew lots for duties, and surrounded him, then with a pointed beam bored his great eye, his single eye, under his shaggy brow. But as a Greek shield or a lamp of Phoebus, of Apollo, so we got back at him, some cause for pride, avenging our friends' shades. So this Greek guy was part of the ones with Odysseus when he got caught in the cave with the Cyclops and they poked out his eye. As for yourselves, put out to sea, poor fellows. Break your hawsers, tall and dangerous, as Polyphemus penning and milking sheep in his rock cave. There are 100 more unspeakable huge cyclops everywhere, at large along these bays and mountainsides. And now 3 times the long-horned moon has filled with a new glow since I've dragged out my days in woods among the wild things' lonely dens, and from a peak spied on the cyclops there, my heart a-tremble at their great footfalls. Their shouts, thin fare I've had, such as the boughs would yield me, berries, cornel fruit, stones with roots and grasses. As I looked out seaward, these were the first ships that I saw put in. Whatever ships they might turn out to be, I handed myself over, boon enough just to escape these unholy savages. A better you take this life by any form of death you choose. So this guy has been there ever since, living in the woods, living on berries, and he saw ships come, and he just wants to leave, and he'd rather be killed by them. He had no sooner spoken than we all saw, high on the mountainside, the shepherd Polyphemus's giant mass in motion with his flocks advancing shoreward. Vast, mind-sickening, lumpish, heaven's light blocked out for him, because he's blind. He held a pine tree staff to feel his way, and the woolly sheep were all his company and all the ease of comfort that he had. On reaching the seashore in the deep water, he washed the fluid from his gouged eye pit and gnashed his teeth and groaned, then waded out to the middle depth, where still the swell came short of dampening his haunches. We made haste to get away and far, taking aboard the suppliant for his plans. So they, in dead silence, we cut our hawsers, launched, and put our backs into a racing stroke. He heard the splash and turned back toward it, but he never got the range of us to reach us, could not breast the full Ionian sea, waiting behind. So they barely escaped the Cyclops, and they took the Greek guy with them. At this, he sent up an unearthly roar, so the Cyclops is hollering, at which the waves on the deep sea were shaken. Italy was affrighted far inland, and Etna's caverns rumbled. Out of the forest, out of the mountains, poured the Cyclops tribe to crowd the bay and shoreline. We could see them standing there, each with his awful eye and impotent rage. The Brotherhood of Etna, towering heavenward, terrifying piers, erect with heads as high as oars in air or evergreen cypress, great trees of Jove, or those in sacred parklands of Diana. Stung to impetuous action by our fear, we hoisted sail to a fair wind, paid our sheets to get sea room, no matter what the course. But Helenus's commands, his warning stood, line 905, no steering between Scylla and Charybdis, that channel so near death on either side. Resolved to go about, to take in sail, we felt, lo and behold, the wind veer northward, blowing down from the narrows of Pelorus. We sailed then past Patagonia's river mouth, Megara Bay, and Thapsus, that low islet, coastal places, Achaemenides, hard-pressed Ulysses' shipmate, pointed out as he retraced his wanderings. So he's telling a story. There's an island lying this side of a Sicilian bay, facing Flammarion Point, where the waves beat. Early people called this isle Ortega. The tale runs that the Aeolian stream, Ortega is Delos, what you see on a map today, Delos. The Aeolian stream, Alpheus, took hidden channels there under the sea, and through your fountain, Arethusa, so this is on the northwestern Peloponnese. It's the Alpheus stream, they personify it. now infuses the salt waves. There, as directed, we worshipped the pure powers of the place, then sailed on past Helorus's rich ploughlands and ponds. We coasted high crags of Pacnius with rocky tongues of land, and far away shone Camarina, never to be disturbed. Then the Gaeolian plain, Gela itself, named for a torrent. Then Betuline Acragus, breeder of mettlesome horses in the past, displayed her distant massive walls, and helped by winds I put Selenus of the Palms behind us, to sail close to the shoal water of Libyan with her hidden reefs, and in the end the port of Dupreon took me in a landing without joy. For after storms at sea had buffeted me so often here, alas, I lost my father, solace in all action and mischance. O best of fathers, in my weariness, though you had been delivered from so many perils in vain, alas, here you forsook me. Never had Helenus the seer, who warned of many things to make me quail, foretold this grief to me, nor had the vile Sileno, that's the bad bird lady thing that flies. Here was my final sorrow, here the goal of all my seafaring, when after this I put to sea, God drove me to your shores. So in his tale, before the attentive crowd, Aeneas's single voice recalled the fates decreed by heaven and his wandering, and he fell silent at last and made an end.